You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Fly in the Car, and please join me in welcoming back the almighty Cliff Diver. They have expanded a bit in size since the last time we had them on. I'm so excited to be talking to co-vocalists Joey and Bree. They're right now wrapping up their first East Coast tour before heading out with Bowling for Soup and Less Than Jake for a bunch of the rest of the summer, so be sure to make it to any of those dates if you can. I'm personally heading to the Connecticut show tonight. Today we're talking about really, you know, everything happening with their debut LP, Exorcise Your Demons, everything happening super organically, and, you know, how they continue their deeply personal and emotional lyrics while continuing to grow more and more comfortable with being open with each other, you know, really, in a way, like, really exercising their own demons through their work. You know, we're talking about some of the darkest moments on the album, how the band kind of reacted to each other and, you know, brought a little bit of light to some of what the other members were feeling, which I think is a really awesome thing and leads to this unique feel that Cliff Diver has. They always want to tell the full story, not just, here are my moments of desperation for you to feel sad with me, but also, here are the moments of triumph, here's the process that I've been going through to work on getting better and continue getting better, and, you know, celebrate those highs even when I know there's still going to be more of those. We're talking about, like, really kind of losing yourself to the full band, applying your own value to others' work, and of course, performing live, really telling the stories and giving context to them, which is, you know, a place I'm sure the band shines, and I can't wait to experience for the first time tonight. So here we go, the return of Cliff Diver to Fly and Call. The obvious biggest change since we last spoke for this podcast was bringing Brianna into the band. And I would just love to hear a little bit how that happened and how it went.
Sure. I love hearing Joey tell this story. So I'm going to.
I was going to let you tell it. I was like, all right, well, let Bri tell this one. All right. So it was, you know, 2020. And there was this little, you know, thing going on for a bit during it. I don't know if you heard, you kept up on the news or whatnot, but so it was a real down time. Everyone was, you know, obviously for obvious reasons, not doing too well. It was so unprecedented and so much of a deep anxiety for a lot of our friends. We'd see people, you know, just really going through it. And so Matt and I decided we were going to just write this really kind of cheesy kind of just good vibes song, right? That was our only goal, was to just like, what's going to make somebody smile today? You know what I mean? What can we do for our friends? It's like they'll walk away feeling like they got a hug or something. So we started writing this song, and we got the idea to like have some of our friends on it, because we're like, what could be better than if we brought in some of our favorite Tulsa musicians? So we contacted Daniel Bazin from When the Clock Strikes. And then I hit up Bree, because Bree and I had been friends for a couple of years at this point. And we'd worked together. Like I hosted her album release show. Like we'd worked together, but never worked together musically. We just kind of like Bree, I knew of Cliff Diver because I'd send her music, and like she'd been a fan for a while. And so it's just like, man, this is that opportunity. We get to work with, you know, some of our favorite people. And so Bree came in and crushed it. I mean, obviously, you can hear the song, you can hear that it just wouldn't have been the same without her. And we quickly realized that. Me and Matt were, you know, outside after the recording, just standing by our cars talking like we always do. And Job was just like, man, we messed up. And because if we ever do the song without Brie, people are going to be mad. So we go, what do we do? And I go, what if? It's crazy. What if? And Matt's like, that would be crazy, but what if? And I was like, I know, right? Shouldn't we at least? And so I messaged Brie and I was like, what if? And she's like, get out of here. Don't mess with me. Don't play with my emotions. And like, I think it took, you know, a couple messages, long messages on my part, just being like, listen. And like, I was doing this hard pitch and she was just like, no, I mean, of course I'll do it. It sounds awesome. You know, like I gotta vet y'all first. So we met up and hung out, and like 10 minutes, 15 minutes in the conversation, we're all just kind of looking at each other like, should we just do it, people are gonna freak out, they'll have no idea. And I'm so glad, you know, that she said yes, because the band is, you know, undeniably better ever since we've added her. I mean, we could have been a pretty good band if we hadn't changed the lineup. We could have been pretty good, you know what I mean? Like, we could have played around opening for people for the next couple of years before we broke up after a disappointing LP3, you know, like, we could have done that. It would have been good. But with Brianna, we had the opportunity to do something great. It just felt, the cool thing about this band has been, anytime we've had an opportunity for something that I think is supposed to happen, it's felt really organic. There hasn't been any like, oh, I don't know if we should do this, I don't know if this is the right idea. It's always like, especially with Brie, Matt and I and our manager Joe, whenever we're brainstorming stuff like that, we're just like, nope, that's it. That's the person. That's the idea. That's what we're doing. And it was the same thing there. It was just like, no, this is it. This is the best thing we could do. And it proved to be true, because you know, we got to write this album, and you know, it was an amazing experience. And I'm sure we'll get into it. But even more than that, like, we get to really chase our dreams now, and we really needed Brianna. To kind of, she's such a otherworldly talent, and she doesn't like too many nice things being said about her, so I'll limit them. But like, it's an amazing feeling. I think for me, it was incredibly validating, because as a singer, and I think of this all the time, even in practice the other night, I was like, just the fact that she thinks I'm good enough to sing with, to share, you know, a front man position with, has done so much for my self-confidence. It's ridiculous. I don't see myself as the same performer I was a year ago, because having that knowledge in the back of my head, like, even when I'm like, man, you're terrible, I'm like, if you were terrible, Brianna wouldn't have joined the band. You know, it's like these moments of like, it's just when someone who's that talented, you know, believes in what you're doing, it allows you to really believe in it as well. So that's the long and short of it, but we're just, it's the best thing ever happened to us. So love you, Brie. Love you.
Love you.
And if you could Venmo me that $10 for that.
You did great.
Thank you. You know, I changed a couple of the words in the prompts, but you know, I thought, no, I'm kidding. It's a privilege. It's a pleasure. And we, you know, we got to shoot a music video yesterday, and it was just like, there were so many moments during it where we were looking at each other and we're like, oh, we could do this, huh? We could actually do this, and this is fun. It's easy, and it's not easy, but you know what I mean. So anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I mean, speaking to just the organic nature of the addition, I will have to say, like, Cat Heaven felt like a bit of a disappointment without you on it, Brie.
I think so too. Thank you.
Well, we're gonna do Brie's version of a couple songs, like, you know, in honor of our girl T Swift. So there'll probably definitely be a Brie's version of Cat Heaven. The one we're really excited about is Elwood's. We're gonna do a Brie's version of Elwood's and completely change the entire vibe of it. So don't know when, but you know, we got time.
Nice. I mean, you kind of just spoke about the overall journey of creating the record, and you know, how, you know, thankful you are for that experience. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, what, you know, made you so excited about the whole process?
Go for it, Brie.
Sure. So
yeah, I just monologued. It's your turn.
Okay, sure. So with the album, I mean, getting me thrown into the mix, the boys at that point had done At Your Own Risk and small hours and all of that. So they kind of had a process. So there was a lot involved with sort of relearning that and kind of folding me in. And it was, a lot of it was exciting to kind of figure out how to make me and Joey sound good together, you know, in this realm, doing what Cliff Diver does. And that was, I mean, in and of itself, it was really exciting. It felt like we were doing something new. It felt, it was just that in and of itself was exciting. Once we found the sound and it was kind of like, okay, this is how our voices work together. Everything we did from then on out was so exciting and so like life-giving. Like it was, it really was just like our cups were just so full. Making the album, we were all going through things, I think, at the same time, kind of weirdly in tandem when we were writing it, but the excitement around what coming together looked like never went away. Like we were writing up until the last day at the studio, and it was, it comes so naturally. Like even not just the additions, not just the, you know, ideas that we have as a band, but the work that we do is very organic. The way we get along is very organic too. It's like, we're so lucky.
Yeah, I mean, Bree hit it on the head. We you know, when we added Bree, and then about 5-6 months after that, we added Gil, our second guitarist, and he also brought in a whole different level of writing, because he has his own band. He's been, him and Matt were in a band together before this called Much Less, which I originally auditioned for, the vocalist for his old band, or I was going to, and I just never did. And then Gil was originally gonna, you know, audition for the lead in Cliff Diver, I found out, and it just didn't fit. And so then like 3 years later, it's crazy, like to have him in it, and it he brings a different kind of songwriting. Like he can write the prettiest, like heartwarming, like beautiful high melodies and stuff. He's really talented. And so with him, it kind of felt like the last piece. Like Matt, Bree, and I were having some pretty good success writing. We were figuring each other out, and I'm glad we had the time to get to know each other first before Gil came in. And Gil's been in for over a year now, which is crazy. I talked to him about it the other day. It still feels like he's brand new, but you know, and we were talking about it with him, and he was just like, man, it's so cool to be able to play and release these songs that I helped write now. And it's like such a more, you know, concrete feeling of being part of it. And we have come together so well over the last year. And I think the album was the first steps to us learning to trust each other fully. You know, there's some in writing was the first step, was being like, okay, there aren't bad ideas. Let's work together. No one's dumb. Everyone is, you know, a good writer. So don't feel like you have to prove that you belong in this room. And I think that took longer because it's more of a subconscious thing. It's more of a, like beneath the surface, there's always that imposter syndrome. And when you're working with people who've worked together for a long time, it can be daunting. And so I think we really got to work it out, and we're stronger because of it. And, you know, we can't wait to start writing LP2, because we've grown so much in the last, you know, 4 months, even, you know, just since we got back from touring this fall, and we were like, wow, okay, let's go again. Let's step up. Let's keep going. So we're in a really cool spot, I think, as a band that has everyone on the same page and everyone believes. And that the studio was like that first moment where we all went, oh, we could do something special here. So.
Yeah. And what was like the magic in the studio like for you?
Oh man, it was tangible. You know, our recording was an entire adventure, and we went into the studio pretty prepared. But things happen, and there were songs that fell apart, or like accommodation situation fell apart, and all we had was each other, and you know what I mean, and what we do and how we interact, and we just kind of had to cling to each other and continue writing. And it like, man, I love getting to make music with them all day long, and especially in a studio where kind of one at a time we can just kind of gas each other up. When we're recording, we'll be, you know, everyone gets applause when they come out the booth. you know, and we eat meals together. It's, I mean, it's so familial, and it really was out there, and especially in situations where we just, you have to rely on each other so deeply. And it's nice to be safe in a situation like that. But yeah, we did a lot of grinding out there. That's that's for sure.
Yeah. And Seth Henderson at ABG is just a delight to work with as a producer, because he's really hands-on. He's not a paycheck producer. He's in there in the muck and the mire with you, you know, trying to figure out what that fourth harmony is. And, you know, we'll be spending an hour on something, a riff, or, you know, because we know that he's like, no, there's something else in there. There's something. And he always pushes you, he, especially in the vocal booth. I mean, like, there's some stuff that we recorded that I still don't know how I sang that high. Like, I've tried to replicate it, and we've had to take steps, you know, like all the great emos before us, you know, to accommodate those. But like, Seth knew how to kind of pull it out. And we worked with the manager on Risk, and we were just like, man, for LP1, we have to go with someone who kind of already gets what we're trying to do. Because we were trying to recapture the things that we really enjoyed about At Your Own Risk, but then make it all new again. And I think that's a theme of the band, is, you know, not the nostalgic tone, but the memories of a memory. It's like, this sounds familiar, but you can't quite place it, but it's also different, you know? And I think Seth really helped unlock that. So that was also a cool part of it. And, you know, much love to Seth Henderson and the fam down in Crown Point, Indiana. We had a great time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about kind of like trying to still capture that, you know, the magic of your other work. I will admit, I was a little nervous when New Vegas Bomb dropped. I was like, oh God, like, this is really good, but is this going to be like different than the Cliff Diver I loved? And I was, you know, so happy. Like, I really feel like you found a good mix between the new and the classic. And can you talk a little about kind of like, you know, fusing those sounds and kind of, you know, creating the sound that doesn't really like keep you boxed in?
Yeah, I think that was super important in the writing, was not kind of taking the easy shots when we had them, which, you know, much to our chagrin now when we're trying to learn how to play them live. But you know, I think it was important to be like, okay, this is the generic line and it works, but how do we, you know, this is too much like the last album. How do we take this idea and then, you know, kind of transmogrify it into something completely different? And I think having, you know, the core, we still have, you know, me, Donnie, Matt, Elliot, you know, we've been doing it for since 2018, which is crazy to me because the pandemic, you know, took a clean 18 months out of that. So the other day I was like, yeah, we've been a band for 4 years, but not really, but kind of. So I think it's intentional that there's some familiarity to the even the structuring of it being kind of a more expanded version of a story that we kind of started it at Your Own Risk. And I think it is the direct continuation. Up until this point, it's kind of all of our songs kind of do fit into a conclusive narrative, you know, to an extent, because they're all ripped directly from our lives, that, you know, we're writing about things that we used to write about, but how is it different now? How is it kind of evolved? And I think so by doing that, just by nature, we had to change it a little bit. And it was a lot of fun. So I think Bree could probably speak on, she has a whole different perspective coming into something that she's already familiar with, but in like a completely outsider point of view. So I'll let you take over from there about the fusing of the new and the old, because you had an instrumental part in that.
Sure. Well, yeah. So, and I knew when they asked me to be in the band, you know, there was kind of a lot to consider as far as like, you know, what that looks like. I can agree to it, but we don't know what's going to come out when we start writing and when we start experimenting, and if we're actually going to, you know, find something that works. It's not just as easy as, you know, replacing a guitarist or whatever. It's, you know, there's a lot of nuance there. And I think Obviously, working with Seth was a huge part of that and was instrumental, I think, in kind of maintaining that with the new twist and turn. But I think it was just, it was so much work. We had to spend so much time experimenting. Like, we went full Molgoth at one point.
we were making Cure songs at one point.
It was like Tears for Fears, ska, goth ska. Like, we were messing with everything. We just decided to go as hard as we could. Every idea, every crazy idea, experiment with different kinds of harmonies, different kinds of interplay between me and Joey. And I think that's one reason we love the album so much, is it is such a concentration of that hard work and also like a real respect and desire to not paint ourselves into a corner, but to preserve that idea of Cliff Diver. Cause I don't want a bunch of people yelling at me about, you know, showing up, well, I don't like it now that she's in the band. Like, you can't really say that because it's still Cliff Diver. It's different, but it's still very much Cliff Diver. And that, I know for me, that was like a huge goal because I love Cliff Diver. And I, you know, if I'm going to be part of it, then if I'm not making it better, what am I doing? A, but B, I want it to still be Cliff Diver at the end of the day and give people what they come wanting when they, you know.
For sure.
Yeah, wonderfully said. I think that was the intentionality, was the not painting ourselves in the corners, because we don't know what's going to come out the next time we write. Like, we have no idea. We're completely different musicians than we were when we wrote this album. And so it's exciting. It's exciting not to be like, okay, well, now we got to, you know, 15 tracks of this exact sound. And if it's not this exact sound, people are going to hate it. So I think we intentionally wanted to keep it kind of open. So there's a lot of genre. We have some, you know, post-hardcore moments. We have some, you know, quiet acoustic stuff. We have some ska. We have some easy core. You know, there's traditional pop punk. There's Midwest emo-y moments. And I think we just wanted to come up with a conclusive, like, Cliff Diver's more of the feeling, not the technicality, I guess. This is kind of the vibe.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, like, you know, spending all that time on the sonics of it, and given the, you know, deeply personal, like, nature of the lyrics, do those kind of, like, flow out more naturally, or do you spend kind of as much time and intentionality on the lyrical side of things?
Very much so. I think that's part of the DNA of Cliff Diver, is these lyrics and an honesty. And that was something we talked about before we started writing, was, you know, where did this all come from? How honest do we get? And it's Cliff Diver. So it's, this one goes to 11. And that's, and so there was a lot of bonding that had to happen. There was, you know, there were days where I had to crying, calling the guys, like, we need to meet today because I have a lot of feelings. And, you know, and then, you know, end of the night, we have like half a song or a whole song. It was very, very emotional and very naked feeling. But I think that's what people expect. And I think people deserve that at least a little bit. You know, some music you listen to forget how you're feeling, and some music you listen to feel a little less alone, or to help guide your feelings, or to validate them, or whatever. And I feel like that's a big part of what we do. So the commitment to that is still very much there. And we were meeting a lot. There was a lot that went into this album. There was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. And I mean, the pandemic didn't hurt as far as time alone with each other in our quarantine pod, but like, we squeezed every drop out of it lyrically. And then, you know, Gil shows up and it went to 100 after that. And I think our process now is just, it's natural.
Yeah. I think that's, it's natural, but also I think they're like living documents. It's not like we write a line and go, that's it. That's it. These songs cannot be touched now. This is the song. I think there were several of them up until we had to literally record the part we were rewriting and changing and editing and going, this line just isn't it. It's just not right. It's just not. And then we'd sit there in the studio and all seven of us and Seth would be, you know, thumbing through rhyming dictionaries and going, I like this line, but this line could be stronger. And I think we're lucky in the situation we have, where we have Matt Ehler as our guitar player, and he is a musical savant. Like, he can just sit down and write a song in like a couple hours. Just, he just sits down, he's like, I don't even know what I'm playing, but here's a song, I just wrote it. Like, can't tell you the chords, can't tell you the key, but it shreds. And it's just like, he'll send it out, he'll normally like email us over a song and be like, this is the new song, and then we start to write on it. But so that takes away a lot of the pressure when it comes to song kind of crafting. Is just that we have this resource, like, Matt, we need a different song now. We need a song that sounds like this. Write me a song. And that's, you know, track five on the album, Death is a Wedding with Eternity. I texted Matt and I was like, hey, I need a sad song that sounds like this, makes you feel this way, and it's about this. So write me a song. And then, you know, he emailed me back, goes like this. And I go, yeah, just like that. You got it. And, so that really frees us up to make lyrics, I think, the focus. I mean, it's not the entire focus. Obviously, the boys all rip. I mean, they're all so talented as musicians, and that allows us to be a little more confident in our ability to kind of dive into the lyrical side of things, because we know that the sonic nature of their performances is always going to be, you know, so such a good stage setter that we owe it to the music, I feel like, to have lyrics that mean something. And so I think that is a focus, that it's one of the things that we hold the most value in, because we are all scene kids, we're all emo kids. Like, we had lyrics written on our binders, on our shoes, on, you know, on our arms. Like, I can still quote the entire, you know, entire albums from when I was that age, because those lyrics sat with me and live with me still. Some of those songs, you know, I just pull up and they're right there in the brain. And we felt a responsibility to be intentional, I guess, is the synopsis. But yeah, I think it was a very important, it's very important to us that our lyrics aren't just, you know, whatever we push out. There's a lot of care that goes into it.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, you talked about kind of like furthering the kind of narrative that you started with At Your Own Risk. And it was on, I think it was on the Good Noise podcast, where you're kind of saying that, you know, you kind of developed the story of the album, you know, kind of in real time, but then, you know, went back and pieced it together after the fact. And I'd love to hear kind of like a little bit more about that process and like the, you know, full album storytelling.
Brief.
Well, yeah. So I would say, I think that it really was unintentional. The At Your Own Risk comparison, it's so funny because we kind of went back and it was like, well, this, that worked out. But at the time, it just the more we talked about it, the more, I mean, I think at one point, Joey actually said, like, this, a lot of these stories are kind of more in depth of what I wanted to tell on At Your Own Risk. And so we did take from that the kind of idea of that sort of manic insecurity and, you know, loss of the self-control, that kind of that idea and place. And then doing the thing that we do, which is, you know, exploring that and kind of ending in it can get better, you know, hope, resilience, all of that kind of thing. And so I think that, like, what happened was, as we started like indulging these emotions that we were having through the songwriting, we kind of, once the songs got started, we could direct it towards the feeling of this song. Okay, I've got a line for this song because we got the chorus for that song and I was feeling that today. And I just came up with this line. I couldn't stop thinking. I got this mantra, whatever it was. And so what ended up happening was we ended up with like these nine entities, nine tracks on the song or on the album. And what would happen is we'd have all these ideas and whatever. And the album kind of explores so many emotions. There's, you know, there's grief, there's insecurity, there's regret, there's hope, there's, you know, this kind of like self-exploration. There's a whole song about, like, it's just very examination and resolution and kind of that switch that happens. And so all of these songs started to, as they started to shape, It was like, as we experienced things and got together again, we had something to pour into that one song based on an emotion that we were having. So we had all these like 9 buckets that were perfectly distinct that we sort of arranged one day. And it was like, oh, there's a story. Those emotions tell a story if we put them from, you know, from kind of the most relatable to maybe the darker ones to the, you know, to the light. And we did have to talk about it a few times because the album gets dark. I mean, it's, you know, Exercise Your Demons. It's a pun, haha, but like it's demons for a reason. And there is hauntings. There is self, you know, sort of like ideations that get questioned. There's all these different examinations that happen. And so I think it's also, there's like a sense of bravery to it too. I mean, I feel that way whenever I know that, like, think about people listening to it and kind of this entire story. But I would say that there's just a lot of that honesty and that bravery and kind of shaped the songs in a way that the order became obvious, if that makes sense. I don't know, Joey, what do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. I don't think, there's some interesting parallels to it where it's like, at the time it wasn't, when we were writing the individual songs, it wasn't like, okay, this song is going to be the one that goes into this song, which is about this. So we want to make sure this song, I think, maybe towards the end, there was a little bit more of a focus on that once we'd kind of gotten a clearer picture of kind of what we had. There was more of like a, like Bree said, that moment of realization where you go, oh, that's what this is about. And that's the cool thing about having 4 people songwriting is we each can assign our own value to individual lines, even lines that, you know, the other one wrote because they become Cliff Diver. And it's not like, you know, here's this, here's that, this mine is yours. It's like, how do we... our saying is always whatever's clever. So whatever makes the most sense, whatever works the best. And then you can apply your own value to it, which is very much what we want for the listeners is like, hey, here's how we see it. But if you see it differently, that's cool too. Like I realized afterwards that some of my lyrical kind of contributions to the album, came from a place deep inside of me where I was begging myself to change, to embrace the next step that I'd been talking about since, you know, I wrote Lost in IKEA. The idea of actually forgiving yourself and loving yourself and moving on to the next step had that journey started with joining Cliff Diver for me, where I began to really continue to step up my care of myself. And so for me, looking back on it now, I see it as myself asking myself to continue to change, to continue not to be sat in the sadness, in the indecision, in the anxieties and the insecurities, but can we push forward to the next step? So for me, I saw it as like, hey man, you got to quit drinking. Like these are the songs, like the first 2 songs is like, how long am I going to keep being this way? How long am I going to keep torturing myself because I refuse to deal with the things that are actually bothering me? Instead, I'm escaping. I'm pushing these down. And I even said to Bree and Matt at one point when we were writing it, I was like, man, if I keep writing these songs about having a drinking problem, I'm going to have to quit drinking eventually. And I didn't realize how true that was until later. And so that's kind of a cool thing about having it like that was that ability to assign your own value to it. And it's kind of cool. It's a special thing. It really is. It means so much to us because it's real for any different reasons. It's really cool to have a collective thing like that.
Yeah. I mean, when we talked last time, you mentioned kind of like the importance of, you know, you felt like telling the full story, not just like the anxiousness, the despair side of things that people can relate to, but kind of like the what happened between then and like now that you're performing it live. And I'm curious, you know, especially with, you know, like you said, a lot of some of the like darker things on the album as well. Can you talk a little about kind of just like sculpting that journey?
Yeah, I think because it is a really vulnerable process for us as we're writing and kind of telling this story. I think it all ties together. And when we do it live is my favorite part of the band. Like I love writing songs. I love recording songs, but it's my passion and my obsession because I love performing live because you get to tell the longer stories that you can't, you know, no matter how many times you tell someone, this is what this song means to me, until you see someone, you know, a grown man laying on stage, you know, screaming and crying. I don't think you can, it like adds a level of like authority to the words to an extent where it's like, these aren't just things that we're talking about. These are things that we're living. And I think a lot of people in our genre, it's kind of share that. And that's what makes this kind of, you know, DIY Twitter scene or whatever, the new fifth wave emo or whatever you want to call it, of people trying to write real things. Of course, you always are going to have that schism of people or, you know, it's easier not to. It's easier not to really self-reflect, obviously. But I think when you're intentional about trying to apply what you're saying to your actual life, then it makes it a bit more of a personal thing that allows us to tell these stories and to not stop at the bad parts and also not to shy away from the fullness of the despair, of the sadness, of the, you know, inevitability of time and these kind of things. I think having a group and having people who believe in you around you allows you to really be yourself. And that freedom live is, you know, I feel like that's some of the times I'm the most me I am, because I get to just let it all out. And it's transformative. It's beautiful.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier also kind of like, you know, the idea of, you know, kind of trying to create lyrics similar to the lyrics that you connected to when you were, you know, a teenager, super passionate about music and stuff, and all in your feels, of course. I'm curious though, like, how do you see that kind of like reflect in your fan base? Like, do you notice more, you know, people who are your peers or younger people who are kind of like in that, you know, kind of mindset that you're kind of writing towards?
Brie, you want to start this one off?
No.
Okay. I think it's kind of wild to me, the whole gambit of the people that we have, you know, sending us messages or coming up to us at the shows being like, you know, these lyrics really helped. I mean, we've had people in their 60s be like, man, you know, I don't like this kind of music, but you know, we played in Oklahoma City and the coolest 50-year-olds in the venue were like, yeah, that was cool. And we were like, all right, cool. If you guys liked it, it must be all right. And, but I mean, we have, you know, kids on Twitter who are, you know, younger and they're like quoting Cliff Diver all the time. I wish they'd quote the positive stuff instead of, you know, some of the sadder songs. When, you know, we have a joke that when you see someone post Cliff Diver, you want to DM them, be like, hey man, just breathe it out, go to counseling. Like, you know, I think that people are starting, when they see us live, they get to see that it doesn't stop at the low points. Like it's still a everyday struggle, but I mean, like people have lyrics tattooed and stuff. It's crazy. Like people have resonated with it. People have found a commonality, kind of community around it. And I think that's why we have some of the best bands of, I think the one thing that kind of unites them all is this desire to find this new way to kind of live, this kind of not stopping and not giving up and not settling, but truly reaching for something else, because we tried everything else. And that's kind of the point of the band, is like, we've tried all the stupid stuff and it doesn't work. And I think we get to interact with a lot of people who feel exhausted and are just like, man, can you tell me it can get better? And we can say, yeah, we can. So that's my pitch. And I'm sure Breeze had different experiences with that as well. I mean, I think that's the cool thing is we each, there's so many of us, we each get to interact with fans completely different. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one thing we've heard, I think a lot, especially like just, you know, as we've been, you know, letting the album around a little bit and stuff, is just that there is a wide range of people who seem to find it accessible. And I think it's important to be accessible. Like Joey says, it shows, you know, parents bring their 14-year-olds who are the fans. Sometimes it's the parent who's the fan. And I think, especially with this new album, I don't know, like the style of music is such a love letter to some really nostalgic things for people in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s. There's a lot of stuff that's just a love letter to like that sort of emo becoming, you know, that post-hardcore grunge becoming emo, becoming pop punk, that whole evolution, like that 1998 to 2008, like Blender, that yummy right there. That's the good stuff. And I feel like we did a lot of service to a lot of those things that we sort of invoked. And I think that, so there is something that's there. And I mean, like Joey and I are parents, we have a certain point of view. And so I think that it is really accessible for people our own age, but we've also been every age of everyone younger than us. And there's a lot coming from that place as well. There's a 16-year-old in here, just like there's a 17-year-old, like all those memories are still there. That brain is still there. And we still speak from a place of that. And we can still access that because the experience, you know, changes throughout time, but the emotions, the way that the helplessness sometimes, the loneliness, that just being that age, being that amount of powerful and powerless, just the things that happen at that age happen to us, we can speak from that point too. And so I think it's like a good thing the older you get, really, if we could change the way we think about stuff. It's really a good thing the older you are, because you can access so much more and speak from those places. And I don't pretend to know what, you know, 19-year-olds are going through right now, but I know what I went through when I was 19, and I'm gonna talk about that to the best of my ability. And I hope what I'm talking about is still accessible, but that's definitely a part of, you know, what we're intentional about, again, is just that accessibility. Because I mean, for me, that's the big reason of why I'm here. You know, I was in a band. We played a lot around Tulsa. We weren't online a whole lot, but I was in a busy band. And, you know, Cliff Diver presented a challenge that I didn't necessarily, you know, I wasn't looking for. Mm-hmm. And, but for me, all the reasons to do it, you know, a lot of them were based in representation and accessibility when it came to the band and to this music and to establishing an authority in that. And so like, I think that we've been really intentional about it. So I think we're going to see, I hope, a wide range of ages that all find this accessible and relatable, because that's the goal.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, one of my favorite tracks on the album is Dick Van Yikes. I love the, will I ever truly see my, see me the way others say I can be, and of course the hook, like the I'll just ride along on this Wonka boat disaster. Can you just like talk a little about kind of how that song came together and you know what it means?
Yeah, that's our manager Joe. It's his favorite song on the record. He loves it, and maybe it might be one that we play on a future tour soon. It might just be one of those songs, but I think that one holds a special place for me, because it represents kind of a pivot in mindset on the album. This kind of, you know, coming out of this haze of a dark night of the soul where you don't know for sure that you were going to be here the next day. And it's like waking up, you know, a couple days clean of a hangover, and you're just like thinking for the first time, you're just like laying in bed, just like, oh, I gotta go do this all over again. But instead of having this, you know, defeated, like, it's Groundhog Day and nothing will ever get better, it's like, you know, whatever, man. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going on. I don't know where I'll be in 2 months. I don't know where I'll be tomorrow, but I'm starting to think that maybe focusing on the hope as much as I can is a way that I can kind of be the person I want to be, because who I want to be is someone who is hopeful and who may not have the answers, as we kind of get into later on, you know, like IKEA Strikes Back. It's this whole idea of, yeah, maybe I don't have it all planned out, but no one does. So I think that if I can just start to trust myself again, then I can start. It's kind of like the fulfilling of that, a more realistic Cameron Diaz, where it's like, if I can just get a little bit of stability, then maybe I can build on that. But it with less of the kind of unearned, I don't know about arrogance, but, you know, it's kind of this idea of, like, when I was writing that song, I was like, and life will be so much better now. And then it, like, got way darker and way harder. You know? And I think that was an important part on this album, was, like, accepting the idea that we don't have it all figured out and we don't have every answer in the world, but that's a good thing. That means there's still things to learn. That means there's still ways that life can surprise us in the positive, as well as, you know, life still being hard. I mean, there's still that questioning in the song of, like, I know I'm still going to struggle with this. You know, one day I still might lose that fight, but today I'm going to be probably okay. And so it's taking those first steps. That's what it means to me. I'd love to hear what Bree thinks about it.
I mean, that's what the song's about. it's sort of that. I mean, because that's it, right? You know, I mean, you talk to 75-year-olds and they're like, I have no idea how I got here. I'm just 75. Please don't treat me. And everyone else is lying, because we are all just figuring it out. And I think that there's an illusion to break that, you know, there's this perfect place, and, you know, maybe there is, and I don't know that I'll ever see it, but I can be okay with knowing that I'm investing in myself enough to at least be resilient, to at least know that tomorrow I can do a better job, and I can at least show up for it, and that there's more coming and I'm going to be here for it. And that's, you know, and it's just that kind of commitment to resilience. It's that commitment to making it through whatever comes, and that turning point from, okay, yeah, it all sucks and I can keep doing what I'm doing, or I can learn how to live with myself, even if it's in a crazy world.
Yeah. I mean, we've mentioned a couple times, the song IKEA Strikes Back, which is, you know, the second single and also the album's closer, and, you know, harkens back to Lost at IKEA on At Your Own Risk. And I really love how they both kind of, like, end on, you know, this rallying kind of cry and, like, with the group vocals. Can you talk a little about, you know, IKEA Strikes Back specifically, and kind of how the two songs, you know, intertwine?
So IKEA Strikes Back was one of the songs that we went to the studio with mostly done.
It was mostly done. Yeah. It was like 69% done. Nice. Yes.
Liza Minnelli. It was 45% done tops.
Yeah, like, at best.
It was worrying. But when we got up there, that song, we had kind of known what it was about. We knew what we wanted to say, and that, you know, this idea, in the same way that Lost in IKEA was kind of that anthemic, you know, mantra built in, this is what we want you to take away from all of this. We knew that that was it. And we still didn't have it when we got to the studio. And I think we actually named it at the studio after we finished writing it. But we kind of knew the direction that we wanted to go with it. And we were having the worst day. I'm going to say, like, top 10 worst day of my life. It was terrible. We were, like, stranded in Gary, Indiana, in this trailer park, like, and we're sitting out by this Lake Minnehaha. And the boys are playing disc golf and I'm fuming because we don't have this song done. What?
Ultimate Frisbee, not disc golf, just for the record. For the record, it was Ultimate Frisbee.
Oh, because there wasn't a basket?
Exactly. That's the only reason.
Excuse me. They were playing and see, I don't play Ultimate Frisbee. I play disc golf. That's why I don't know. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching them play and I'm frustrated. I don't know how they're playing. I'm happy for them that they can relax and have a good time, but I can't. And I'm like, we have to show up tomorrow with the chorus for this song that we don't have. Or an outro, and half the verses are just whatever. And what's so funny about it is I'm sitting there and I wrote the chorus watching them playing disc golf. And they get done, they come up and I was like, Matt, I got it. And he was like, knew you would, hit me with it. And train left the station. And from there, it was so funny because what we were going through fed so much into that resolution that's in that song, and that you know, I'm kind of looking up from the gutter, you know, that situation and that point of view, that was very much where we were. So that's what naturally came out. That outro, I wrote it down on a coffee filter, and I went to Joey, and I was like, I think I got it. Like, this is all I've been thinking all day, and I can't stop thinking about it. I think it's it. He looks at it. He's like, Bree, that's it. And I'm like, I don't know what to do with it though. And so he wrote the music for it. And he was like, this is how we're going to chant it. This is how it's going to go. And it was beautiful. And it was so encapsulating, the song itself, of what we were going through in our mindset. It's so like transparent. I don't know how else to put it. Cause we were talking to ourselves in writing that song. Like, we're going to get it. We're going to get it.
Yeah. I mean, we had the verses, and then we had one iota of a line for the chorus, Another Year Alone. That's all we had. Because we were singing it a different way originally, and that's it. That's all we had. We kept writing. We were writing the entire time we're in the studio, trying to come up with better ideas, good ideas. And there was just nothing. We knew we needed to tie a bow on it. We knew we needed to kind of bring this album together. And it's, you know, some of my favorite things I've ever written and sung, and that were very emotional for me. That second verse especially, it's a, you know, kind of a love letter. It's a letter to my dad about what a great dad he is and how I hope I can be, you know, the dad he is. Cause that's, you know, a big reason for me trying to become a better person is for my son, because he deserves it. He deserves a dad that's going to be around, both physically and mentally. And he deserves the world. He's a great kid. And I so much of my struggle in the past has been this feeling of being useless, of never going to be able to be a good father, a good enough father, and that I'm always going to be this mess, this pain ridden, you know, open wound mess. And I could never be a good enough dad. And that tortured me for a really long time. And I think, this song's kind of like this promise I get to make to him of like, you know, I'm on my way now. I promise you that I will own who I've been. And, you know, like, that's what the song became, like this mantra to us. Like, Bree came, you know, brings those lyrics, and we go outside, we have the phone in between us. You know, the other guys are laying down their chorus melodies, like harmonies and stuff, and we're up, like, we gotta finish this thing. And she's like, here's some lyrics. And I read them 3-4 times, and I was just like, yeah, I mean, this is what I want to say to me. And it's what I want to say to 17-year-old me. It's what I want to say to, you know, me in 10 years. This, like, it resonated, and you know, it was such a quick process after that. We did it in 3-4 minutes, where, you know, once, and that's the cool thing about writing with someone, when you get on the same wavelength, it is something to behold. It is such you know, a cosmic affirmation. It feels like, where you're like, oh, okay, yes, And then here's this part. And then it's, yes, of course, that's what it is. It's almost like we're getting things like the, you know, layers are coming off and we go, oh, it's always been that. That's what it's always been. We just couldn't see it because we were trying to be too clever or too, you know, whatever. And I think when we go back to just kind of sharing where we are, I think that's when we're able to be the most effective as a band. I think whenever we're able to not make it too cool or clever, and we can kind of bypass all the performative emotions and get to the core of it, that's, I don't know if this is the right path, but I do know that this is way better than it was. And if all else fails, like, at least progress is being made. At least progress is happening. And that is good enough, because when you've been stuck in the useless trap, the whole of this is just who I am. I wish I could change, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I think that's an easy place to get stuck at. And some people never get out of it. You know, you'll meet people in their 50s and 60s who are just like, that's just who I am. If you don't, and it's like, you run at that first sign of cognitive dissonance. But, you know, I think when you're able to stand against it in this, like Bree said, this kind of brave moment of declaration of, gosh, I don't know if this is going to work out, but let's do it. Let's just do it. Let's quit waiting on the perfect opportunity, because it doesn't exist. You have to create it. So that's kind of that song. It's a very special song to both of us. I mean, it is a mission statement, if there ever was one, for who we're trying to be as people. Like, we're trying to get better for our sake, but also for the people who count on us, because we're not alone in this thing.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess kind of like going off the idea, you know, the album title being Exercise Your Demons, I'm curious kind of like, what is one of the like darkest moments on the album for you, and kind of like what was the release of, you know, like writing it out physically and, you know, performing it?
Yeah, I think Brie and I both have one song that we kind of each wrote, that are kind of these two, track 4 and 5 are kind of like these real sad songs. And I'll let Brie talk about, you know, track 4, which she wrote the majority of, and I think is a masterpiece of a song. But track 5 is about a nightmare I was having. As I kind of talked about this on Good Noise the other day, but it was this repetitive dream that had dug its way so deep into my psyche that it became a haunting. It was a very real dream from with someone who had died, and but it was tangible. You know, it was this like, she was there in those dreams. It felt very much so. And accessing that was really hard. And we knew it was going to be when we wrote it. You know, when I originally, like, because that's one of the songs I sent to Brie when we wrote it. We wrote 5 first. We wrote these verses. And it's a different side of me vocally, I think. It's kind of this... almost soliloquy. It's like this performance, this like real rage against the future, against your lot in life, against everything. And it's just this Shakespeare, like it was very much for me like Hamlet, you know, act 3 scene 2, that to be or not to be, like, am I going to keep doing this, or am I just going to quit? Because if I'm just going to quit, I'm just going to quit, because I can't keep doing this. And then it was a really dark and heavy song, and it is to an extent, but it's also a beautiful song because it represents this kind of shift in focus for me personally on how I viewed these dreams, where I thought it was this malicious thing. And then Brie and Matt wrote this chorus that changed the meaning of the song to her perspective. And they took, and I'll let Brie talk about that too, because she has a really cool story about when they wrote that, but it changed it for me. At first, I hated it. I hated the chorus. I was like, no, absolutely not. This is not it. And then I listened to it a second time and went, no, this is it. Yeah, never mind. But it changed the way I viewed this. And as not her being like, come join me, come die. But her being like, no, don't you see that I mess up and you can't mess up too. I'm trying to get through to you to say, hey, this isn't the way out. There's no reprieve here. Like there's no easy way. And you're romanticizing this thing that's actually not what you think it is. So for me, that's one of the darkest moments. And then track three, Frankie Muniz, No Smoke, No Mids, just the chorus is, was something that I really struggle with. I don't know, you know, I don't know when I'll stop feeling like the villain in my own story. Because I feel like so many people can relate to that. It's just like, okay, well, I figured out what the problem was. I thought it was everything else, but it's just me. And so that's a hard feeling. But those are probably, I think the dark moments on the album, but it's not where it stops. So that's why I love them so much.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, the conversation around sort of suicidal ideation is not new to the Cliff Diver canon. And it's not something that is, I think, shocking as a topic, but I do think that the exploration of it here, especially how it relates to how Joey was telling his story in track five, Death is a Wedding. That song, I mean, it was, we had to talk about it, four and five. Like I said, it was something where four, it was the song I was saying I had a really bad day. I called the guys and I was like, we have to get together tonight because A, I don't want to be alone, but B, because I think I can use this. And, you know, we talked about a ballad and I wanted in on that. And I felt like I had a lot going that day. And so we got together and I want to say we almost finished that song that day, track four. It was me and Joey and Matt, and I think Gil came about halfway through, but we just sat down and the guys helped me, but we just wrote this whole story about this sort of that contemplation and sort of the ideas that you have and sort of fit it into the story that Joey was telling with track five, where it's kind of that conversation with someone who has crossed that line and you're looking at the line thinking about it, you know, and I think we're not afraid to say that we've seen it, we've looked at it, we've considered it. And that's kind of the admission we're making here and kind of the peak behind that. So for track four, for me, it was just that idea. What are those thoughts when you're preparing to very seriously look at that line and that kind of idea of wondering what people would think of you for doing it, what people would think of you for getting so depressed in the first place and messing up to that point, what your life's become, all of the different things that kind of start going when you indulge that thought is kind of track four for me. And leading into that track five, where Joey talks about, losing his fiance to suicide. And when he didn't have a chorus, you know, it was, you know, the verses had been done. He sent them to me years ago. This song has been amazing for a long time. And we'd been developing it it was just incredible. And we wanted to approach it correctly because it was so perfect the way that it was. So anything we added needed to just be added. And so we were listening to it. And I don't even think Joey was there at first.
No, yeah.
Joey wasn't there. And we were listening to it. And I was like, you guys, like, if I'm going to do the chorus on this, and I'm being honest, I just feel like let's have a conversation, because the song before, we're talking about looking at it. Song five is really considering it. Like Joey says in the song, like, sometimes this seems faster than another, you know, or this seems another 50 years of pain. Sometimes this just seems faster. This is just easier. It's the out. And I'm like, but we need to have that thought that contrasts that. Cause I don't think she would beckon him that way. I don't think someone who loves you would beckon you that way. I think if anything, you know, on the other side of it, you'd be telling people you love to that you made a mistake and that, you know, you shouldn't have done that. And as someone who has survived an attempt, that is the feeling that you have afterwards. It's kind of like, thank God I failed. And you don't want anyone to succeed with that ever. And so kind of that becoming a conversation, and again, something we had to talk about a lot in presenting, but it was kind of like, no, that's what I would say. That's what I would say back as, you know, somebody who's been in the gray. It's like, I would say, no, like you, I love you. Don't do this. Think about it, whatever. And so kind of delving into that, going to that place and thinking about what you would say to someone you love who's on the other side, but flipped, it was an exploration. It was a very honest exploration. And we had to talk to Joey about it, you know, afterwards, like you said, where it was kind of like, listen to this, see what you think about going this direction. And I love that he loved it and got it. And, but that I, you know, just bringing that other side to it was so important for that balance in the song. So I think as always, you know, an exploration of the deep, but with a clear understanding that there's better, there's hope, there's something else, there's other options. You know, there's, it gets better.
Yeah. I'd say even that subtext exists in New Vegas Bomb. I mean, it's a fun party song, but the subtext of the song is I want to party until I am no longer whatever state I'm in. I just don't want to do it anymore, whatever that ends up being. Hopefully it'll, because I think I was passively suicidal for a lot longer than I was actively suicidal, where I was doing things intentionally that were dangerous, that were you know, painful and stuff like that, because I didn't care if I lived or died. And you know, I joined the army so I could hopefully die, and that didn't work out. It just made me more sad, you know. And like, these were kind of like, when you're dealing with grief and loss, like, you just don't want to feel that way anymore. And so you're looking for whatever out there is. And I think like Vegas Bomb is so fun because it's a fun party song. But then like, the whole point is I want to be erased. Whatever it is, I just want it to stop. I want to stop. If it's me, if it's the pain, whichever one comes first, something has to not feel like this. And if that's being obliterated, you know, and that's kind of the theme. The first half of the album is kind of that slide into the question, into the moment at the end of a long weekend where you've crossed all the lines you said you weren't going to cross again, when it comes to like taking care of yourself and partying. And then you end up with this existential moment where you're staring into eternity and you're going, well, you know, is this it? And I was trapped there for a long time until I almost died. When, you know, in 2016, I almost died. I had an accidental overdose. It's a long story about a time loop and an acid trip. But I remember laying on the table in the ER, holding my dad's hand as they were trying to like get my heart beating correctly, and me being like, I'm so sorry. This is not what I wanted. This is not what I wanted. And I wanted, and I almost fetishized it for so long. It became this golden escape that was always there. If things got bad, well, it doesn't matter. I'm probably going to end my life anyway. So whatever, man. And that was a moment in my life where things started to get better. After that day, suicide went off the table as an option. I still struggle with the ideations constantly. That's just depression. It's never going to stop. I'll be having a great day. You know, everything's going well. And then my brain will be like, yeah, but we could just crash the car and die. That'd be sick, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be sick to be dead? And you're like, no, shut up. I'm trying to move on. So, anyway, it's a.
And a big driver, I would say, for the reason why all of this made it out is because, as honest as Joey is, like, it encourages that same honesty, like, out of me, out of anyone else who, you know, is in the room writing. And you find out by talking about it how much Joey and I, you know, have in common with that. And it's like, well, if I know exactly what you're talking about, you know exactly what I'm talking about, then for sure there's other people who know what we're talking about. And so it's, again, goes back to that, like, that bravery where we just had to make the decision to be like, no, this is the thing that people go through, because if it's here, then it's out there. So let's do it.
and if we can earn people's trust that we've been where they are, then maybe they'll listen to us when we say it gets better. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, well said.
And I think that's a perfect segue into what's always my last question, which is, asking for a piece of advice or something you've been thinking about. You know, if someone's in a position you've been in the past, or, you know, if you want to talk to a new band just starting out, or, you know, whatever kind of advice or something you've been thinking about that you would just like to share.
Comparison will kill your drive faster than anything. I'm not talking about inspiration. Inspiration's easy to get from other people if your mind's in the right place. But I mean, there's so many things I would have done with my life earlier, and things I would have done, things I'm doing now that I could have been doing for a long time if I had stopped comparing myself to other people and talking myself out of things. So I would say, you know, and it seems so cliche, but it's fine. Really take time, because everyone says, you know, find out what's great about you and then capitalize on that. And no one tells you how long that takes and how much intentionality that takes and how much sitting with yourself that takes. Explore your art, explore every little bit of what being an artist can mean and do and what you can do. And then do what feels right. Don't compare it to other people. Take inspiration from other people and leave the rest at the door. And don't let that stop you, because I am insecurity central. And as I get older and as it falls off, I wish somebody would have hit me and said, like, get to know yourself, love yourself, and then just be the things about you that you want to be, and stop worrying about how it looks next to what somebody else is doing.
I'm going to try and take that advice currently. That's great. You know, that's great.
I mean, we deal with that, like with the band, it's like with sitting on an album for so long, and people are having releases, they're announcing tours, and like, with how amazing everything's been received and going for us, we kind of seem like brats now looking back. But at the moment, we didn't know anyone was going to like any of this. We didn't know, you know, Side One Dummy was going to want us. We just knew we were dumping all of our money and time into a project, and everyone else is, look at them go. And it's something that could have taken us out at the knees. It's real, 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 real shit that you cannot look at other people's wins and make it a reflection of yourself. It is, you know, arrogance and insecurity are two sides of the same looking at yourself coin. Like, just let it be.
That's wonderful advice. Yeah, gosh, that resonates. I love that. I mean, and even still to this day, like yesterday we're making a music video, and there are moments where we're like, Bri and I were looking at each other. We're like, was that any good? And we're like, yeah, of course, that was awesome. But it's like, still there's that part of us that's like, they're going to find out that I'm not the same level that they are. And even comparing yourself to other just individuals, like, well, that'll get you up the creek fast. I'd say my advice, the thing that I've been working on the longest, and is still an everyday thing, is forgiving yourself. And it sounds easy. It sounds so easy. Like, you got to forgive yourself to move on. You go, of course. Yeah. I forgave myself. Yeah, it's fine. You know, I think my self growth took so much longer than it could have if I could have ever actually looked at who I was with more than just hate, or who I you know, was 2 months ago or yesterday or the day before. And it was always with such a feeling of contemption of, you stupid idiot. Like, how could you not see this coming? Like, how many times can hubris kick you in the face before you realize, like? And it was always this lack of patience and this, like, you're doing this thing again. You should already be better than this. You should know better than this. And I think that ties into that, the feeling useless thing. They come together in this just carousel of self-deprecation. And that's where it starts. It starts with, we suck, I suck, you know, little offhanded comments to deal with the insecurities, you know. But it became an obsession, where everything I said was self-deprecating. Every single thing was, I'm a piece of shit. You know, I'm a piece of shit, or blah, blah, blah. I'm an alcoholic, whatever, blah, you know. And it starts as a defense mechanism. Then becomes something that becomes defining in your life, where even when you do try and break out of it, you've built up so many mechanisms in your brain that begin to tear apart any argument you have that things could get better or that you could get better, because you have the, you know, all the facts, you have all the evidence of going, well, if I was really going to get better, I would have got better by now. I'm 34 years old. When am I going to stop this? When am I going to stop that? But like, until you're able to look at yourself and go, man, I really was trying my best then. Even if it didn't look like it, even if it looked like I was just being an idiot, like I was in so much pain and I was so scared of everything and of being hurt more that I thought if I just, you know, created this full defensive shell then I could survive. But like life's about more than survival. But you also have to like recognize the fact that it's something we all do. We all revert to these kind of defensive behaviors when it comes down to ourselves. Because I can tell people all day that you are special. Don't let me hear you talking trash about yourself or you're going to, you know, I'm going to mess you up. But then people will be like, okay, you challenge, you start it. You don't say something nice about yourself. And I'm like, shut up. We're not talking about me. We're talking about you. And so I think honestly taking that moment and forgiving yourself for who you used to be. And that also applies to performers. Like I spent so long like apologizing or like cutting people off and they'd be like, hey, this song means a lot to me from the first EP. And I'd be like, oh, that song's trash. How could you like that song? That song is so stupid. You're an idiot. Like, cause the new stuff's so much better, but it was because I couldn't handle having any imperfections. You know, I couldn't handle growing. I always wanted to be grown. I didn't want to grow. I just wanted it to be done and for me not to have to do it anymore. But that's not how it works. So have some patience, have some kindness towards yourself. And remember that like,
there's still time. I mean, you can always restart. You can always change your ending. You can always change who you are. Now, I'm a completely different person than I was a year ago. Completely. It's not even close to the same thing. And it was painful, but it took time. Man, I can look myself in the mirror most days without flinching. And that's a nice feeling. So if I can do it, and I'm the biggest idiot that's ever lived. So if I can figure it out, then I promise you, you can too. Just don't give up before it turns around, because it can. I promise. So that's probably my advice. Nice. To anyone who needs it. And to me. Still.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I feel like there's a million more things I could ask you, but I don't want to take too much more of your time. Is there anything that we haven't done that you've been like really itching to get out about the album, about the tour, about anything else Cliff Diver related?
There are things, but we can't talk about them. Today was a good day in the Cliff Diver camp.
Big thing coming.
Oh, shoot.
Big thing's coming, local band.
We're just really grateful. We've built this huge team, and not huge, but they are huge. They're huge people. We're all huge. But like our manager, Joe, our booking agent, like we have this like team of people. It all sounds so professional, but we're all just friends, and you know, it's they're all connections that have been made organically. You know, we don't put out an ad for looking for a booking agent, you know, like stuff like that. It's people who have sought us out and a team that we've built. So I would just say like I'm really excited about tours that are coming up this year and maybe some festivals and about everything that our team is sort of like, they just believe in this album and us so much. The label's been incredible. Side One Dummy, I can't say enough about how supportive they've been and how much, you know, they love the album and stuff. So I guess I would just say like, I'm excited because I think Cliff Diver is getting ready to just really hit some new, evolve a little bit, I guess, and hit some new highs this year. And I'm really, I wish I could tell you specifically what they are, but that's what I want to say. Cause that feels a little bit relieving if I can't give specifics.
Love it. Love it.
I would say we're also super pumped about our tour with Carpool and Goalkeeper. Those tickets are available on our website, cliffdiverok.com. Matt would kill me if I did another interview where I didn't mention where you can find tickets or give any, our socials are cliffdiverok.com, you know, as well. So,
But we're super pumped about that tour. We're hitting East Coast for the first time. Cannot wait to make new friends, play with some awesome bands, and hopefully meet all of you. Anyone who's listening to this podcast, I hope I get to meet you in May, June. If not, then, you know, maybe one of these other tours we can't talk about quite yet. Maybe, possibly. But we're very excited. We're excited. I mean, that's end of the day, like, we get to actually take a run at our dreams, and that's the craziest thing still. And I don't think it'll ever stop being surreal.
All right, and there you have it. If you haven't checked out Cliff Diver and specifically Exercise Your Demons, definitely get right on that because it's fucking amazing. Cliff Diver are the kings of the new wave. Whether you want to call it emo, whether you want to call it pop punk, it's a little bit of everything, and it's truly awesome. I think I'm going to be switching for at least a little while to a bi-weekly schedule, just to let you know. I know my schedule's literally been all over the place since I started this podcast, but, you know, I think bi-weekly is the right choice for me for a little while. So I'm going to be coming at you 2 weeks from today on June 21st, and it's going to be another awesome band. I'm not sure who it is yet, but we're going to make it happen. Fly on the Call is brought to you by Sound Talent Media in partnership with Evergreen Podcasts. A special thank you, as always, to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Jirai for the theme song, and Michaela Jane for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at FlyInTheCallPod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at FlyInTheCallPod@gmail.com. Things are hard, but there's silver lining when it gets better.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.